You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine, which is the sponsor of this podcast. This podcast is available on all major podcasting platforms and on occasion on radio shows as well. Today, we're taking up the very grim topic, you know, the true monster of our age, which is war and militarism, particularly as the regional war in the Middle East continues to escalate, continuing Israeli attacks on Iran and retaliations from Iran, with the goal, it seems, on the part of the Iranian government to entangle the United States or to have the United States be brought in to do a job that Israel alone cannot do. Now, this war is opening up all sorts of political fissures on both political parties. Both political parties have, in varying degrees, pro-war and anti-war constituencies. And it's particularly interesting because Donald Trump ran both in 2024 and 2016 as the candidate of peace. He emphasized in 2024 that there were no major wars under his watch in his first term, and he intended to keep it that way. What's happening now is a real betrayal of his promises, which also opens up political opportunities for the Democrats. And to talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on Matt Duss, a frequent guest of the program. He's a vice president at the Center for International Policy and writes on foreign policy in many venues, including Foreign Policy, where he has a big piece on how Democrats can retake the mantle of being the anti-war party. So first of all, Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jeet. Great to be with you as always.
Before we get to the politics of the war, I mean, I just want to get your sense of, you know, where the situation is, because it is in flux, but it's a pretty dire thing that's happening, both the war and the retaliation, and especially the prospect, I think, of, American intervention, direct intervention, not just supporting Israel. I mean, the argument for it is that, you know, the United States can take out Iran's nuclear policy program in a way that Iran can't. But that's actually like not apparent to me that they can do so successfully. And that opens up a much more dangerous world. But do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So where we are a week into Israel's war on Iran, which news hit Washington last Thursday evening. I remember I was at, you know, one of those dinner discussions with a bunch of people in suits that they throw all the time here in Washington. And the news hit and you could see people just kind of checking their phones and their faces dropping. They're like, oh, crap, it's happening. But yeah, and leading up to that, you know, Trump had been engaged in talks with the Iranians to come to a new agreement on to limit their nuclear program, to put a cap on their nuclear program, to bring it under control, to make sure they can't get a nuclear weapon. And the reason that this was such a huge problem is because Donald Trump pulled out of the previous nuclear agreement back in 2018. Remember, in 2015, the Obama administration, after years of effort, signed with Iran alongside its P5 plus one partners, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, a pretty detailed and extensive agreement to, you know, put Iran's nuclear program under surveillance, under restriction. And everyone agreed that that, you know, deal was working. Could people imagine stronger deals? They could. You can always imagine a stronger deal. But in terms of the world of the possible, I think the overwhelming majority of nonproliferation and security experts thought that was a good, strong deal. Donald Trump didn't like it. probably for no other reason that it was Obama's deal. I mean, Trump knows very little about these things, but understood that as a result of him pulling out, Iran had continued to enrich uranium to higher levels. So he rightly was committed to the diplomatic track. And I wrote a previous piece saying, this is good. Democrats should support this. If Donald Trump gets a good nuclear agreement, you know, just the fact that it's Donald Trump and we don't like him is no reason to oppose it. Unfortunately, all the while, Benjamin Netanyahu, along with hawks here in Washington, in Congress, people like Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, the usual gang of you know, warmongers, were, you know, kind of in Trump's ear saying, no, they're playing you. They're getting close to a nuclear weapon. You need to let Israel strike. And you know, maybe we even need to strike ourselves. And Trump was resistant to that. But it appears, and people can read the kind of TikTok that came out from the New York Times a couple days ago that lays out, you know, how Trump essentially changed his mind and went from being an anti-war president to a president who is now on the brink of, you know, he's already supporting Israel's war, but drawing the United States in directly. You know, that war, you know, Netanyahu launched the attack. It was Thursday night. DC, kind of Friday morning, Iran, and Trump has been considering whether to come in support, mainly because only the United States has big enough bombs, these 30,000-pound bombs that have to be dropped by US B-2 bombers, that could potentially destroy or at least do significant damage to the Iranian nuclear facility at Fordo, which is, you know, buried deep inside a mountain, a very hardened facility. So that's where we are. People are waiting to see what Donald Trump is going to do. He says he's open to more talks with the Iranians. Why would the Iranians join talks with Trump? Because after that's exactly what they were doing. He has tweeted, you know, some pretty terrifying things, like calling on people in Tehran to evacuate the city. This is a city of over 10 million people. He has tweeted, you know, unconditional surrender, all caps. Like, what does that mean? Or should the Iranians surrender to the Israelis? I mean, what? I mean, and again, so you don't want to kind of try to figure out or make sense of all this. We all know that Trump is just a creature of his obsessions and appetites and moment to moment. But unfortunately, it does seem that, you know, Netanyahu and other hawks have gotten into his head, that this is the path. And I think it's A, disastrous. But B, Trump betraying his promise to be an anti-war president does create an opportunity for Democrats to get to move back into that lane, which they had abandoned. And you and I have talked about this, too. I mentioned this, you know, in the most recent election, Kamala Harris seemed it was important to kind of lean into this kind of tired militarism. We want the most lethal military in the world and out there campaigning with Liz Cheney. All of which I think people recognize was a bad move. I mean, a lot of us were pointing this out at the time because it was patently obvious that this will not help you win the election. But Trump doing this now...
Well, Harris also said that, like, Iran was, like, the major threat to the United States.
And again, and there's a way to acknowledge and talk about, you know, the problem with Iran and the bad stuff it's doing while still saying clearly that this is not the way to handle it. That's what Democrats should be doing. And we had a president who was able to do that. His name was Barack Obama, who was actually fairly successful in not only, you know, addressing the Iranian nuclear challenge, but in, you know, in fighting and winning an important debate in Washington. Democrats need to rediscover their ability to do that.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, it does seem that at least the Democratic Party that was running, you know, in 2024 ran a, you know, like a very hawkish campaign, a very traditional strategy going back, you know, well into the Cold War with JFK of like, you know, trying to outflank the Republicans on the right on foreign policy. And as you said, like, the, you know, like, it doesn't seem to have paid much electoral dividends. And I think it might also have had real cost in terms of like, if this is who you're catering to. And I think it's maybe worth underscoring some of the costs because now the Democratic coalition as it exists includes, you know, a significant hawkish faction that has a real voice. I mean, you tweeted about this, but I mean, like, do you want to talk about our friends, the neoconservatives?
Sure. I mean, I want to talk about that, but just want to go back. I mean, everything we said about Harris, you know, was right. This does have echoes of the Cold War, John F. Kennedy, but it's not always been that way. In fact, there have been candidates who have campaigned as more pro-peace and more anti-war, and they have won. The most obvious is Barack Obama. Another is Joe Biden. Like in 2020, Joe Biden campaigned on ending the forever wars, going to get out of Afghanistan, going to draw down the war on terror, a lot of which he did. You know, got out of Afghanistan, less, you know, kind of really diminished drone strikes, a number, you know, a number of other good things. Obviously, a lot of that was overshadowed by the Gaza catastrophe and the fact that he was kind of we're engaged in this Ukraine war, which we didn't start, but are nonetheless still involved in. So anyway, getting to the question, yes, I mean, you're referring to what I said about Bill Kristol today. There was this article in the New York Times of people who, you know, looking at the debate we're having over whether Trump should intervene. And it's just so depressingly just 2003. And it's a lot of the same people. It's John Bolton. It's Bill Kristol saying the same stuff that it'll be quick. We can solve the problem through bombing, which we can't, which we couldn't then, which we can't now. But the reason I point to Bill Kristol, it's like no one is under any illusions that John Bolton's a Democrat, right? Bill Kristol is one of these, quote, never Trumpers who can't, in 2016 decided, oh, I can't get behind him, and got a lot of credit, you know, among Democrats as part of the anti-Trump resistance and this whole idea that we need to build a united front, you know, for this, you know, dangerous threat, existential threat that Trump represents to our democracy. Now, my issue with that was twofold. One is there's no acknowledgement that Kristol, and this is also true of Liz Cheney, who's got enormous credit for sacrificing her congressional seat because she wouldn't go along with Trump, which, okay, I'm willing to give, you know, a couple slow claps for that. But Kristol and Cheney are two of, like, the Dr. Frankensteins of Trumpism. You know, these are people who spent 8 years under Obama just attacking him in the grossest way, just fear-mongering about terrorism, suggesting that Obama was himself sympathetic to our enemies, sympathetic to Muslim terrorists. And of course, Trump picked that stuff up and ran with it. So there's never been any acknowledgement of the role that they played there. But the second, and I think more important problem I have is just more pragmatic. These people don't speak for any real voters, okay? Liz Cheney's endorsement was good for one vote. Liz Cheney's. Okay. The same with Bill Kristol. So this idea that, you know, we need to ally ourselves with these moderate Republican never Trumpers. I mean, for what? Listen, if they want to vote for Democrats, that's good. I'm glad they're voting for Democrats. But, you know, this idea that they represent kind of this meaningful part of the coalition is nonsense. It's more, you know, their main audience is moderate Democrats who want to believe in this kind of, you know, West Wing way that there's, you know, this fantasy of moderate, reasonable Republicans that we can all still sit down with. And I'm sorry, we should have learned from the most recent election, Republicans will vote for Republicans.
Yeah. No. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a very meaningful constituency there. And actually, to go back to like what you were talking about earlier, because I think this is a point that's worth underscoring, and I don't think it's understood well enough. Because in your foreign policy article, you mentioned this, that going back to like the end of the Cold War. So, you know, let's say like 1992 was the first like post-Cold War election. You know, with the Soviet communism collapsing the year before, like in every election except for 2004, which is obviously overshadowed by 9/11 and by the passions of that moment, in every election, the candidate who has run more arguing for a more peaceful American foreign policy has been the one that won. That's a very striking thing. And I don't think it's like political analysts consider that enough. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. I mean, I refer to this a lot. I refer to it in my most recent piece. I've written about it before. Yeah, as you said, in every election since the end of the Cold War, 1992 on, with that one exception of 2004, the post 9/11 election, the less interventionist, the less militarist, the more pro-peace candidate has won. Now, again, does that mean that in all of these presidential elections, this was the determinative factor? No, I'm not going to argue that. But I do think we have a pretty good data set at this point, you know, and I do think that is worth taking into account and understanding what that says about the electorate. They are not isolationist. I think that's just a pejorative that's used in Washington to try and police the debate and kind of avoid a debate rather than engage in one. But they are reasonably wary of these large-scale interventions that bog us down and waste money and waste lives and waste resources and credibility that we need to be spending elsewhere. And most importantly, they don't keep us safe. They don't make us safer. There is a sizable constituency of American voters who clearly understand that, and they have handed the presidency as I said, to the less interventionist candidate in all but one of our post, you know, post Cold War elections. And I wish Democrats would take that into account.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think I'm underscoring the sort of political valence of this. And you quoted this like very interesting J.D. Vance op-ed in the New York Times in 2016 at a point where he was like anti-Trump. But he said, you know, like one thing that Trump understands is that Americans are wary of war. And I think there's actually some really good sort of like political science indicating that in 2016, you know, the places in the Midwest and in the Northeast where like Trump won, like in, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the military service and people who had been in military casualties were greater than the places that he hadn't increased. And so it seemed like that his promise of ending the forever wars and his critique of George W. Bush's foreign policy really resonated with a lot of voters who had would not otherwise have voted for Republicans. That seems like like if one is just thinking in cold political terms, like that's something that's worth knowing.
Yes. Yeah, I remember it very well. That first big debate, and I think it was 2015, where he was on stage with like two dozen other candidates, and he kind of let it rip with like the Iraq War was a huge disaster, 9/11 was George W. Bush's fault, you guys have screwed it up. And you know, the only people who were shocked by that were on that stage with him. Like everyone else in the country who was watching that was like, yeah, that's right. Finally, someone has said it. And again, Barack Obama himself, he won because of his opposition to the Iraq War, his prescient and courageous opposition to the Iraq War. We need prescient, courageous members of Congress now, Democrats who can say that and understand that there's a lot of people who are ready to hear that.
Yeah, no. That's absolutely right. And I think that, I mean, to just stick with the Republicans for a second, and then we can like talk about the Democrat side. The Republican Party under Trump is really a cult. There's a kind of MAGA cult, and people will go along with him, as we're kind of seeing now, but not like totally. Like that sort of anti-war constituency that he called into being, and that sort of, you know, more longstanding, you know, really actually going back again to the end of the Cold War, where like there were fissures on the Republican side between the sort of neoconservatives and the more old right paleoconservatives like Pat Buchanan. There's a longstanding thing. Then that element, maybe not huge, but it is a part of the right, is not very happy with this. And one is seeing this, you know, I think a lot of our viewers will have watched that clips, at least, of that debate between Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz. And, like neither of them great favorites of mine, but, you know, like the way that Tucker Carlson really showed up Ted Cruz's, you know, fundamental ignorance, it actually speaks to the fact that there are people, you know, like on the right as well, on the Republican side, who are not very happy with this, and they might bite their tongue right now. But, you know, this is not a popular war.
Right. You know, and I want to understand, again, these are not, I'm an admirer of neither of these people. I think, you know, I think they're both despicable in different ways. But I'm going to go with the guy who wants to slaughter fewer people. And in this case, that would be Tucker Carlson. I mean, his reasons for wanting to avoid war are almost certainly not mine. I think he's just one of these people who's like, why are we bothering with all these brown people in the Middle East? We should be paying attention to stuff here. But still, he's against this war. And I also think, you know, people should watch that and take lessons for how he challenges Cruz. Because Cruz, as you know, he's done a great job of promoting himself as this great college debater. But what you see is like once you push him off his talking points, he just really falls apart. And he's got all these little tricks where he tries to turn it around back on you and challenge the premise of the question. And Tucker's just not having it. And you can watch, it's just delightful. And I have to say that it was delightful to watch this unctuous doofus, Ted Cruz, just struggling under the withering questioning. And it's not, I mean, it's not even aggressive. I mean, you know, Tucker is just kind of like doing, he's making that Tucker face. Like, I don't understand. And you know, and again, Cruz just kind of collapses. So it's like, journalists, take notes here. Just challenge, if you push them past these talking points, you will find that there is nothing much there.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, yeah, it's not like, you know, like I wouldn't say, Tucker Carlson is like, you know, James Baldwin going against William right. Buckley. Like, this is not, this is like you just asked a very basic, simple question, which one would think, like, you know, would always be asked if you're going to war, like, you know, like, how many people are in the country that you want to bomb? What do you mean when you say that, you know, the Bible tells us that we have to support Israel? Like, where does this come from? Very basic questions that, like, never get asked. In terms of thinking about the politics of this, like, I actually do think that, like, in addition to the fact that there's a lot of, you know, like, anti-war Democrats and anti-war moderates, independents, I think actually, like, dividing the Republican coalition and pointing out, you know, like, increasing the fissure on the Republican side is actually, like, good politics and can actually, like, open up a lot of very productive changes in American politics if that, you know, like, if the hawks on the Republican side realize that there's a political cost on their own side to this. And I think that's why the Tucker Carlson, Ted Cruz thing is significant. It's not like Carlson is a great debater, but Ted Cruz went on that program because Carlson has an audience that Ted Cruz needs. Yes. He, you know, he speaks to that, like, large right-wing MAGA audience. Yeah. And, you know, like, that audience is like, you know, like, saying, like, wait a minute, we signed up for an anti-war president. Mm-hmm. What's going on? That's an important Fisher point. And, you know, like, a competent political party would realize there's a wedge issue here.
No, I'd say I totally agree. And I will say we have seen some Democrats coming out strongly, like Ro Khanna, who's usually very good on this stuff, Chris Murphy, of course, Bernie, Tim Kaine has introduced a War Powers resolution or a bill under the War Powers Act to force a vote on this, which I think is important. So we will have, you know, congressional action on this in the coming weeks. People should be paying attention to that. But I also have to say one of the responses that I really found most surprising and encouraging was from Senator Jack Reed, who is the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, not known as a strident anti-war progressive at all. He's seen as just a very centrist, security-minded Democrat. And his response just called this Israel's attack aggression, reckless. It didn't have any of the usual throat clearing about Israel's right to defend itself, because, of course, this is not self-defense by any definition. So, again, I think, you know, that's a signal to other Democrats, you know, in terms of how they should think and speak about this. So, again, we still have a problem with, you know, the leadership of people like Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, both of whom are super pro-Israel, super kind of taking their guidance from AIPAC and conservative pro-Israel, very hawkish forces. But it's, again, we have more and more evidence that the party is changing. We've long seen that the voters in the party were expressing different preferences. But I think it's finally, slowly, far too slowly, but still, you know, the representation in Congress is speaking up for this stuff, too.
Yeah, yeah. I've been, like, sort of monitoring the number of people signing up for these bills. I don't know the we're recording on Thursday. The last time I saw it was, like, in the 30s. It's, like, just slowly kind of gaining force. And of course, like, on the other side, AIPAC immediately tried, you know, mobilized and got a whole bunch of people in Congress of both political parties to sign up with, you know, like, I Stand With Israel. So this is actually sort of a political mobilization that's happening. And I think the fact that it's happening in Congress is actually a very heartening sign, because one of the things, you know, like, you know, one of the problems here is the imperial presidency. And, like, you know, like, Donald Trump or any president should not be able to go to war with Iran just on their say-so.
Right. And again, this is where I come back to the Bill Kristol and, you know, the Never Trumpers, is that you've been telling us for the past 10 years that this man is a dangerous, unhinged, you know, would-be autocrat. You cannot then turn around and say, but also we should let him lead us into another war. You are either telling me that you are lying or that you're an idiot. And, you know, a lot of these people are not idiots. So again, I just find there's this enormous tension, if I can put it in the best possible terms, between arguing that Trump represents the threat to democracy and that we should let him lead us into war, especially, and this goes back to, you know, my point about never having to hold, you know, be held to account. It's those wars that helped deliver the, you know, Trump himself. Okay. War generates support for authoritarians, the nationalism, the xenophobia, the war fever that always accompanies wars, always generates support for the, you know, exactly what we are seeing in this country and in other countries around the world. You know, it couldn't be clearer.
No, I think that that's absolutely right. And I mean, like, in terms of, like, you know, worrying about imperial blowback, I mean, the fact that the way in which Trump is treating the military as, you know, his personal security guards and private army, and sending them into places like Los Angeles, that is like a direct consequence of like the war on terror and the militarization of American society. And then, yeah, there's been like precious little introspection. To go back to like Jack Reed from Rhode Island, and the because I mean you quoted him, and I think that is actually very significant, and I think there might be other indications as well that like the opposition to this war would be coming not just from the, you know, the usual very large and underserved chunk of the United States that like is not enthusiastic for war, but like within the military industrial side of things as well, because like in a lot of ways, like, you know, like for the United States to get into a war with Iran right now, like, makes no sense. And like, you know, like I would have to imagine that there are people, you know, like traditionally very centrist, hawkish type people who are perhaps less beholden to AIPAC than Chuck Schumer, who are like kind of actually worried, like, you know, like, what exactly is the United States doing?
No, I think that's exactly right. And for good reason. We've run this play before. And this is part of what's so baffling about this.
Yeah. No. Especially baffling. I mean, I think maybe to underscore the, you know, national security side of things, or the American national interest side of things. I mean, like, it seems to me that, like, Israel, or at least Israel, you know, as Netanyahu conceives it, and he is the prime minister, you know, like, I don't know if there's any mileage to be gotten by saying this is Netanyahu's war, if he's been, you know, serving as the prime minister of Israel longer than anyone. So the Israeli government, the Israeli, you know, political point of view is to get the United States involved with Iran. And like, that kind of makes sense. Like, if I were a small nation, you know, in this region with other forces, like, I would want, like, you know, Big Brother to come in and do my fights for me. But like, if I was like the Big Brother, I would also think like, I actually have like other interests rather than Israel. And so, I mean, to me, like, that's the kind of, I can kind of see like what Israel's goals here are. And it's not just stopping Iran's nuclear program, right? Like, because I mean, like, Netanyahu's been talking about regime change, and I think one should actually conceive that as regime smashing. Like, I think maybe, you know, like, it's not necessarily they think they can put in a pro-Israeli regime, but they want a civil war or a divided Iran.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it should go without saying. I mean, Netanyahu makes these videos with appeals to the Iranian people. We are supporting your liberation. No one takes that seriously, okay? Benjamin Netanyahu does not give a crap about human rights or liberation for anyone, even for Jews.
Yeah. No, and one should mention that, like, within Iran itself and the Iranian diaspora, like, many people are like very critical of the Iranian regime, are saying, like, you know, like, this war is not going to like liberate us. This is not something.
He has a very specific. Yes, he has a very specific vision of what, you know, security means for the state of Israel, that in, you know, is inextricably intertwined with his own political survival. And, you know, I would also add this, even though clearly we are in this mess because he was able to convince and manipulate Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is very easily manipulable for people who know how to do it, because he's an ignorant and, you know, deeply emotionally damaged person. You know, Putin was able to do the same thing. I don't like when people are saying, oh, Israel is controlling U.S. foreign policy. No. I mean, we have gotten into this mess ourselves. We have a long history. There are people in this country who believe that the best way to handle the Middle East is for essentially to empower Israel as our local sheriff. And it makes sense what Netanyahu is trying to do, as we see him like attacking in Yemen, attacking Lebanon, attacking Syria, and now attacking Iran. It's not to, you know, collapse these states. It's just to make them weak states that cannot challenge Israel and the U.S. in the region in any meaningful way. And I think the idea that this will lead to durable security and stability is a dangerous fantasy. Okay, people need to point that out. And I hope we don't learn that it's a fantasy by the next October 7, you know?
No. I think that's right to emphasize that there's like a large constituency in the United States, and not just the United States. I mean, I did actually see, you know, various statements from European leaders, including one from Germany, saying like, "Well, Israel's doing our dirty work for us." First of all, I don't actually think, like, in the long term interest of Israel. Like, I think, like, being the sort of, you know, pointed edge of the sphere of, like, you know, Western imperialism in the region.
No. Listen, that quote from Mertz. I mean, if you wanted to, I mean, you could not, you know, if you tried to come up with something that just ultimately discredits the Europe and the West in the eyes of the global majority, just say that. I mean, it's just, it's offensive ethically, and it's stupid strategically.
Yeah. But certainly within America, I mean, there's this, you know, militarist factions, you know, like, who do want to view a sort of splintered, you know, divided, like, weak Middle East as, like, in America's national security interest. Wonder are we offering like an alternative, is there like some sort of vision of like the Middle East that can be like, you know, different than this? Because I think that that's usually like a big kind of like major weakness, and like certainly like, you know, there's a Tucker Carlson view, which is like, you know, like, no, let's just
pull out, let them fight. Yeah, which is attractive, but it also, it kind of lets us off the hook for the role that we've played in, you know, supporting a lot of the stuff over the years. And again, the problems of the region are not entirely our fault, but the United States is not innocent. We have supported some of the worst actors in this region and continue to do so. So again, I mean, my colleague Nancy O'Kale and I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs earlier this year that tried to lay out a progressive vision of foreign policy that also addressed the Middle East, which is where she's originally from and where my work was, where it has originally focused. But in general terms, there is a way we can have a relationship with this region that is not just entirely based on selling arms and supporting dictatorships and repression. That's not to say that we have the power to transform these governments or these societies. We have neither the right nor the capacity to do that. But we can come up with an approach to the region that takes security seriously, but also supports, you know, the better actors rather than the worst ones, which is what we've been doing.
I think that's right. And maybe in particular, I mean, to broaden out, because it seems like, you know, Israel and the United States, in supporting Israel, are fighting wars on multiple fronts in, you know, like in Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, as well as in Gaza. I mean, like, what one would like to see is, you know, some sort of articulation, like what should America's policy towards Syria be? Is it actually in our interest for the Syrian, the current new Syrian regime to fail, to be like a weak government? Because I mean, that is what Netanyahu is trying to do, and you know, they are like, you know, Israel is destroying Syrian villages to set up military bases,
right, to keep Syria divided and weak.
Yeah. Is that like, you know, like is there a way of articulating like, you know, a foreign policy that like actually says like, you know, like Syria is a country that has suffered like tremendously in the last decade or more, and like, is there a way in which, you know, like it's actually America's policy to like try to help them rebuild and to get some measure of security?
We can start with international law. I mean let's just start there. The United States, you know, it's cliche because it's true. It's like we constantly appeal to international law as a cudgel against our adversaries, but we have a special exception for allies and partners like Israel, most egregiously, but not only. And again, this is I've written about this repeatedly. I mean, you could not have designed a better social science experiment to lay bare the hypocrisy of the so-called rules-based order than Ukraine versus Gaza. You know, I mean, much of the rest of the global majority was always quite aware of these hypocrisies because they suffered at the pointy end of it. But listen, if we are trying to create a world of rules and not simply might makes right, which I think we should, not just because it's a nice thing to have, but because this is the only way to create real and durable security for all of us, we need to hold our partners to account. and ourselves first, you know, most importantly.
Yeah. No. I think that's right. I think it's very important to think about this holistically, as you have, like, in terms of, like, what are the kind of broader goals. So, as you mentioned, like, you know, like, the fight is coming up in Congress. What are the sort of political prospects for this? Like, do you think, especially since, you know, like, I think that this is, something that ordinary people could actually, like, get involved with. There's already, like, a very strong anti-Trump resistance. There's, you know, like, a remarkably robust pro-Palestinian movement. Like, is there, like, you know, move for a room here for social movements to start putting pressures on members of Congress to, like, you know, like, try to stop this Russian
war?
Yeah,
I think the more the better. The more they hear from constituents in support of these measures, the better. I mean, every office tracks calls, emails, letters, and making clear that there is strong support for these war powers resolutions, but also opposition to this war, because ultimately that is what the goal should be here. The war powers resolution is a tool of process. It's a way for Congress to assert its Article I authority and, you know, at least have a debate about war that we tend to avoid. It's a way of getting Congress to do its job. But I don't want Congress just to have a debate. I want to stop the war. So I want people to be very, very clear about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, politically, like, what do you think the prospects are? Because I do think, you know, like, as you said, Congress likes to avoid these debates. And one reason we're in the mess is that it's, like, kind of easier to just let the president declare wars. But like, do you think, you know, like, if one actually has people in Congress having to put their names to say, like, you know, like, I say, you know, like, I'm supporting the United States fighting in Iran, like, what are the actual prospects, like actually, like, you know, using this as a political wedge and, like, actually, like, you know, dividing the opposition?
That's absolutely part of it. Forcing members of Congress to raise their hand and put their names and take ownership of a new war, a potentially even more catastrophic war than we've had in the past, I hope will shake some reality into some of these people. But again, as we noted earlier, I mean, Trump is a leader of a cult. As he said the other day, I decide what MAGA is. If Trump decides that MAGA is doing the opposite of what he promised he was going to do a few months ago, then that's what it is. So I don't want to understate the challenges here. But I'll also note that, you know, Congress has passed two war powers resolutions in its history. The first was in 2019. That was Bernie's war powers resolution on Yemen. The second was in January 2020, Tim Kaine's war powers resolution on Iran that came right after the Soleimani assassination. And those couldn't have passed without Republican support. I think we got 8 on Bernie's and then 7 on Kaine's. But we still were able to get enough Republicans in a closely divided Senate to pass it. I don't know if we'll get there. But I do think this is a tool, not only a legal tool, a constitutional tool, but also a tool for mobilizing. And that's how we're using it.
Yeah, no. I think that's right. And, like, I mean, I want to emphasize the political aspect of this and the mobilization aspect, because I think that, you know, this is, like, a remarkably dark moment in history, and, you know, when one considers all the catastrophes that came out of the global war on terror, and the fact that, you know, like, 20 years down the road, we're, like, heading towards a mistake of a similar magnitude, it's easy to get very pessimistic. But I think it's also worth emphasizing that, you know, this is a political battle, and there's political organization to be done. And it's also, I think, you know, from your foreign policy piece, I think it's actually, like, a political battle that can be won. Perhaps not immediately, but, like, I actually think that, you know, the forces of opposition to, like, what's happening are very, very strong. And if they're properly organized, they could have a huge impact.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I also, listen, I'm thinking also about the 2028 primary. And as I said in my foreign policy piece, it was 2000, I think it was 2002 or I forget, or 2003 when Obama made that famous speech opposing the Iraq war. I want to see speeches like that right now, that people will remember in a couple years.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Or I think even like in 2026, I think there's gonna be a lot of primary fights, and I think that whether Democrats like it or not, and I think there are people in the establishment who don't like it. This is gonna become a political battle within the party, and political battle that has to happen. But on that note, which I think is a very productive note of like thinking towards the future, I want to thank Matt Dust once again for being on the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Gene.
From the office to a first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They combine timeless style with modern performance materials to keep you looking good and feeling comfortable all day, no matter what's on today's agenda. Browse everything from shorts and polos to sweats and crews. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.